Last time, right at the end of our discussion, John Goddard asked a question, and I said that we would begin this time with that question. And so I'll go ahead and pose the question, and this can be something that we begin by discussing, or it can be something that we just keep in mind as we look at the different chapters and maybe have as a general theme of our discussion. I'm fine with doing it either way, whatever you all prefer. But the basic question, which is one that's connected with this book, these readings, and I think is an important question for us in general as Orthodox Christians, is given that we live in a society that's spiritually sick, and given that we are striving for spiritual health, how do we stay strong and stay on the right path, let's say, in the midst of the surrounding society, which is so much opposed to everything that we're striving for as Christians? Another way you could put it would be, you know, that we're swimming against the current of the society that we live in. How do we do that? I think the way John asked it was something like, how do we stay strong? And also, how can we help the society around us? How can we help to heal society versus being infected by the society? Obviously, we're already infected with sin, but we can be influenced for the better or for the worse, depending on sort of the company that we keep, the things that we pay attention to, what we do with our time, what we expose ourselves to. This is the general question. How do we exist within the world, given that it's spiritually sick, without being influenced in the wrong way? And how can we ourselves be an influence in the right direction for the people around us? Of course, we're called to be light in the world and to be salt for the world. This is what the Lord says in the Gospel, in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, you're the light of the world and you're to be the salt of the world as Christians. So this is our calling, but obviously it's challenging to do that. To swim against the current, to be so countercultural, and not to give up, not to be discouraged and influenced by society to the point that we just give up fighting. And we talked last time about the idea of being like a frog in a pot, or like the fish, where you're gradually heating up the water, and the fish doesn't notice because it's cold-blooded, and its body temperature is changing with the surrounding milieu, the surrounding environment. And so that's always a danger for us, that we become desensitized to things, that we're gradually exposed to things, and time goes by, and pretty soon we don't even notice how much we've changed. So we don't want to let that happen. We want to try to help those around us. How do we do that? So that's kind of a general topic for us to think about as we continue through our study. It's one, if anybody has any thoughts to share right now, we can do that, or we can just revisit that idea as we go.
Well, as I was reading chapter 7 and kind of along that same vein, I kept thinking of the little song that we, as a Protestant, we learned as little kids. I don't know about other folks, but be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. And then be careful, little ears, what you hear. And on and on. And I kept thinking about that because he reiterates, you know, those same sentiments in adult fashion. But I thought, you know, that was a pretty powerful song for little kids that it had a lot of meat to it, a lot of good life skill lessons in it to try to prepare us for the onslaught we would have as adults.
That's a wonderful example, and yeah, you're right. I think that's a powerful message in a very simple form, and it's a message that I think is being lost more and more. You know, just this idea that we ought to protect our eyes and we ought to protect our ears, and that's very much part of our tradition. But I think so many of us Christians, even people who you know, we claim to take our faith seriously, we don't give enough thought to guarding our hearts by guarding what we allow in through the senses. The fathers, some of the fathers use the language of guarding the eyes or custody of the eyes. This is the kind of the traditional language, keeping custody of the eyes. So in other words, sometimes if somebody is immodestly dressed or there's some image or something like that that could cause some temptation, then what you're supposed to do is to avert your eyes, you know, and you read in old literature about this kind of thing, you know, this sense of modesty where, you know, you let's say, you know, a woman is accidentally somehow, you know, in a compromising position or something like that, and, you know, a man of honor would turn his head and not look, you know, so to avert your eyes so that you're not sort of giving yourself over to this passion. So absolutely, that's a song that we would all do well to learn and to sing, I think. And but you're right, the book is kind of saying the same thing, and so much of our literature, our spiritual literature, is telling us to do just that, to guard our senses. So we need to take that to heart. Absolutely.
The other thing is in one of the chapters, it talks about distractions and the importance of not getting distracted. And there are certainly, without going into depth, there are a lot of things to be distracted with out there.
Definitely. Yeah. So one basic point that song makes, and that Archbishop Evariki also makes, is here at the top of page 87. He asks, and this is coming right after he quoted Christ, who says, out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. And so the Lord is making clear that the real issue is with the heart. It's the state of the heart. And when the heart is corrupt, then all of these things proceed from it. But how do those things get into the heart in the first place is the question. And so Archbishop Evariki is responding to that in here at the top of page 87. He says, where do evil thoughts in the heart originate? They do not arise there of their own accord, but emanate from outside. Stand guard over your heart and examine the thoughts that enter therein. What is their nature? This is the precept that the holy ascetics who worked upon cleansing their hearts of sinful passions have bequeathed to us. Stand guard over your heart, that is, keep vigilant. Keep your attention on yourself, keep attentive watch over all that happens in the innermost recesses of your soul and heart, and do not allow anything foul or unclean to enter. Our hearts are soiled by harmful impressions that we receive from outside, from the world surrounding us, which, according to the apostle, lies under the sway of the wicked one. And then he makes the point, children have a pure heart. They come into the world with a heart that's pure, but
The longer they live in this world, their heart is increasingly soiled, losing its initial childlike purity. And that song is beseeching children to be careful, you know, because so quickly they can lose their innocence, they can lose that purity of heart. We who are adults know that, and you know, we want to encourage our children to be careful. But also, it's not that there's no hope for us who have already had our hearts sullied, but that we can begin from now to guard our hearts. And you know, that's why we have confession, so that we can try to get this stuff out. But then moving forward, we want to guard what we allow back in. And so we need to take that seriously, to guard our eyes, guard our ears, be careful what we hear, be careful what we see. We can't expose ourselves to just anything, thinking, well, we're mature enough to handle it or something like that. That's a trick.
And I think it's also important that the rest of that song, or the rest of that phrase, is, for the Father up above is looking down in love. So it's not a avoid these things because I'm the ruler and I am, you know, going to pound you in the ground if you do. I think it's really important that the song says, you know, because the Father up above is looking down in love. It's, he wants to protect us and keep us from harming ourselves or other people too. But I mean, you know, it's discipline through, it's a loving discipline.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's just like, you know, parents just wanting the best for their children. We don't, you know, I always use this example, but we don't discipline our kids for running out into the street because we just want to be mean or something, or, you know, it's not cruelty. It's, we're trying to protect them from getting hurt. And it's the same with God, that He designed us. He knows what our hearts are created for. And when we use our hearts the wrong way for the wrong things, we give them to the wrong things, then we're just harming ourselves. So that's absolutely, it's His love that, as we say, punishes us, or rather corrects us when we're going the wrong way, because He knows that's self-destructive behavior. And you know, we're going to destroy our hearts, and He doesn't want us to do that. So that's exactly right. Yeah, it's not, this isn't, again, we as Orthodox Christians, we're all about morality and you know, acquiring good morals. But it's not about moralism, which means, you know, sort of thinking in terms of, well, some, you know, this category of people are the good people, these are the bad people, those are the bad people who do bad things, you know, we're the good guys. No, we're all together, sick people in the hospital, trying to get well, and this is the course of medicine, of therapy, that's going to help us to be well. It involves guarding our hearts. It involves guarding, being careful about what we allow in. So no, it's not about condemning people. It's about showing the way to acquiring good health. Yeah. So it's love. The Father up above is looking down with love. That's wonderful. And you're right. You can't have the one without the other. You have to make that clear. If we turn the page from 87 and look at 88, right in the middle of the page, he asks, from what, therefore, does one need to protect his heart? One must shield it from the disorderly influx of all sorts of harmful external impressions. This is impossible, you may say. Of course, in full measure, it is impossible. In other words, you can't completely wall off your heart from all evil impressions, right? If you're living in the world, even as hard as you may try, some evil impressions will come inside, right? You just simply can't completely wall yourself off from the surrounding world. So he's saying, in full measure, it is impossible. It is impossible to be unaffected by the impressions of this world while living in it. You can't be completely unaffected. But it is possible to limit the onslaught of harmful impressions. It is possible and necessary to struggle internally with them, striving to eradicate them from one's heart. This, after all, is the essence of the spiritual life, which is nothing other than a struggle, particularly a struggle with sin. And the ultimate source of sin in one's soul are the harmful impressions accepted without struggle and allowed to bring forth their lethal fruits in the soul. So we can't completely cut off all harmful impressions, but we can limit them if we're trying to do that. If we're focused on doing that, we're aware of ourselves, we're aware of our surroundings, and we're deliberate about what we expose ourselves to and what we don't. You know, you might be driving around and you see a billboard, or you might be watching something and you didn't expect something to come up. And it comes up, and now it's too late. You've seen it, and you can't unsee it. And these kinds of things will happen. But if we have certain standards, we say, well, we're not going to watch certain kinds of movies, and we're not going to watch certain kinds of shows, and we're not going to listen to certain kinds of music, and we're not going to expose ourselves to certain things, then, you know, we can make a big difference in how many and how bad those harmful impressions are that we're allowing inside of us. I think, brothers and sisters, it's only going to get harder because the world around us, that like the standards of what's allowable, of what's acceptable by the culture, it's just been a nosedive over the past 50 years. You know, it's just gotten worse and worse, decade by decade, year by year, and now it's moving so fast, it's like it's just in free fall. I mean, unfortunately, I've seen, like some recent things, some shows, haven't watched them and haven't listened to the music, but just read about them in articles by people worried about, you know, or concerned about these things and saying, you know, can you believe, you know, that these rappers are singing songs with these kinds of lyrics, and can you believe they're showing this show on Netflix? And just reading about it, I feel completely defiled. You know what I mean? Just reading, like, this is what's going on, this is what they're doing, this is what they're saying, and, you know, these are the kinds of lyrics that they have. It's awful. Just completely awful. So, yeah, it's hard. I mean, just the world, the popular culture is just so much in the gutter that it's like you almost can't watch anything or, you know, even the news, or even reading Christian authors critiquing the culture, you're exposed to stuff. And that's where, I mean, other than just trying to limit what we take in, and also I would say confession is a huge thing, because even if you're struggling with a thought, to say it, to name it, to get it out, to expose it, takes away some of its power, so it doesn't continue to have a hold on you. And then the other thing is, I would just say we have to be very close to the Mother of God, because she is all pure, and she can convey her purity to us if we are open to that, and we're asking for it, and we're asking for her intercessions. That's a powerful means of dealing with those kinds of impurities that come inside of us. Call on the Mother of God often. I love the prayer, Most Holy Theotokos, save us, just as a way to kind of, when something, an impression comes, and you're trying to put it aside and get rid of it, and to bring your mind and your heart back to a place of purity and focus on Christ, I find that prayer, Most Holy Theotokos, save us, to be incredibly powerful.
So would you say that We should, you know, some people think they have to critique everything, you know, even good people, they have to critique everything that's going on. Yeah. If this book is right, and it is, then we only have to really do that, apparently, until it's really absolutely necessary to go full depth into critiquing all the bad stuff that goes on. Otherwise, you sort of, it seems, let it pass or don't give it a second thought, even though we know it's having its effect. We just sort of, in a sense, let it pass and ignore it without having to focus.
Yeah.
On it.
Yeah. I think that's connected to the principle that Saint Porphyrios articulates very clearly, which is that when he says, when the devil is coming to you and you sense the presence of evil, he says, don't pay attention to the evil, don't pay attention to the devil, instead turn your attention to Christ. So it's like, okay, we know there's this evil over here, but what he's saying is the evil one wants you to pay attention to him. You know, he wants to distract you, right? So again, this idea of distraction. He wants to pull your attention towards him. And St. Porphyrios is saying, don't pay attention to him. St. Paisius says the same thing, you know? He says, like, when the devil comes and starts to tempt you and you hear these tempting thoughts, say, thank you, Satan, I had forgotten to pray. And then immediately turn your mind to Christ. And he says, then the devil won't stick around because he's, like, helping you to pray instead of distracting you from prayer. So that's the way to defeat him. But St. Porphyrios says, don't attack the evil head on. And this is when we're dealing with our own personal struggle, right? Don't just like give your attention to the devil. Just say, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to look at that. No, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Just turn to Christ, he says, as quickly as you can. So don't, like, you're right. There's this danger of thinking, well, we need to analyze this. We need to understand it. I would say that I think certain people are in a position or have a calling to try to understand what's going on in the culture in order to give warnings for everybody else. There's this sort of like prophetic role. And to some degree, that's the work of clergy. There's certain people maybe who have a gift for discerning things. I think of Father Seraphim Rose, who had an amazing ability to sort of look at philosophy, the history of the world, you know, different currents and different things that are going on, different religions, sects, what they're teaching, and then to kind of synthesize and analyze and to clearly state, this is the difference between orthodoxy and what they're saying, and, you know, to give that as teaching for everybody so that everybody doesn't have to go and, like, read a whole bunch about the Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that, right? Like, that's not edifying. It's enough for somebody, you know, to just teach us a little bit about, okay, watch out for that. This is seductive because of this. Watch out for that, you know, and you know, to think clearly about these things. So I think there's a role for that, but I think for the most part, most of us, we're better off not paying very much attention to a lot of those things, going just to know that they exist is enough, you know, but not to like. I remember I had a professor in seminary, Dr. Rossi, who was adamant about this. He said, like, people believe this lie, like, in order to oppose, you know, the culture and to be able, you know, like, it's necessary to be aware of everything that's going on, so that you have to watch MTV or something, like, to know what's going on, so that then you can, you know, oppose it and pray against it and explain. He said, no, don't turn it on. Don't watch it. Don't expose yourself to that garbage. It's not good for you. You know, like, you're not as strong as you think you are, kind of thing. Like, no, just flee from it. Avoid it. You don't need to know everything that they're saying on MTV. You basically know the kind of stuff that's, like, if you've ever watched it before, that's enough. You know what's going on. That's enough. So, yeah. So again, it's like knowing our own weakness and therefore limiting what we expose ourselves to.
Now, you got to be careful stepping on toes of the generation that grew up with MTV there.
Hey, I was like,
Jay,
that's me.
I see Jay and Charlotte, they were like smirking too.
Yeah, oh, no, I mean,
I want my MTV.
I understand.
I have not watched MTV recently. Yeah. I didn't even know it still exists, but
I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. I have no idea if it still exists.
The very first day.
You watched it on the very first day?
Yeah, the very first day I watched it.
So, That reminds me. I remember eating dinner with my family, with my parents and siblings. I think it was a birthday or something like that. We were in a restaurant, and some music came on, and it was like the Beatles or something. You know, it was some kind of music from the 60s, and my dad like knew all the lyrics, right? And I just remember him saying, he was lamenting. He said, "What if I had spent all that time that I spent listening to that music, reading the Psalms, and then I would have all the Psalms memorized? And instead of having the Psalms in my mind, I have all these lyrics of all these songs in my mind, you know?" And it's like that. Like, yeah, I mean, we've sort of given ourselves over to all of this time spent listening to this music, watching videos, whatever. And it's like, that's all in our soul now, you know, and it affects us. And it affects us in ways that we can scarcely even understand. So there's like a long detoxification process, I think, as Orthodox Christians, where we're like no longer exposing ourselves to things. And that's the first step. And then gradually to kind of go through and recognize, oh, that wasn't good, and that wasn't good, and trying to get that out of our souls. So again, it's no condemnation. I've watched MTV, I've watched, you know, music videos, I've listened to all kinds of terrible music, I've watched terrible movies, I've been exposed to all the same stuff. But Dr. Rossi's point was, don't, as an Orthodox Christian, think you need to expose yourself to this stuff just so that you understand what's going on in the culture, so that you can sort of critique it and whatever, and be able to. And he was kind of saying also, like, for people who are doing youth ministry, like, you don't have to like expose yourself to all this stuff in order to understand what's going on with the kids. Like, it's enough to know such things exist. You know, it's enough to have just a basic idea of what's out there. You don't have to spend hours watching this stuff in order to talk to the younger generation or something like that. I mean, human souls are the same. Even if they're not listening to the Beatles or, I don't know, REM or U2 or whatever anymore, or Guns N' Roses or something, they're listening to whatever they're listening to now. And it's just worse. I mean, it's like more of the same but worse, you know? So it's enough to know that. You don't have to know what all the lyrics are. That's kind of the idea.
I think movies, though, have more influence on kids nowadays, or on us in general. Yeah. I mean, pretty much on all fronts. That's some of the things which I think the sexual revolution came through, and like the lesbian, you know, LGBT, whatever it is. That's one of their biggest ways of conveying that on our culture. I mean, you can't even watch like regular TV without being influenced by that culture nowadays. So that's the part that's hard, is it's just in our general, even on just watching a basketball game or a football game, you got to worry about like Super Bowl entertainment. It's just a whole big list of things, but anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, I would just say, we're just, as Christians, we're called to be countercultural. And that's really always been the case. But I think in times where the culture was more Christian, you know, it wasn't as obvious, or you didn't have to be as radically countercultural. I think in times where the surrounding culture is basically pagan, then you're very countercultural. And that's how it was for the earliest Christians, you know, when they were surrounded by pagan culture, and more that's how it is for us. And what that means is, like, things that are just taken for granted, we just choose not to do, you know? I mean, the pagans in the first few centuries of the church, they were going to the arena or the theater, you know, they were watching stuff that Christians refused to take part in. And I think it's the same for us. We just have to say, you know, make a choice. I'm not going to watch TV. It's all garbage, you know? It's not good for my soul. I'm too weak for that. Even if I'm going to watch the Super Bowl, I'm sure not going to watch the halftime show. I mean, there's, like, the last time that was something edifying was probably, you know, decades ago, if it ever was. So, yeah, I mean, it's like, you have to be a little, there's, like, some common sense You have to be smart about what you're gonna expose yourself to. And just because everybody else is doing it, I mean, like every parent says, that's no reason to do it just because everybody in the culture is. No, we have to make a choice to be different. So yeah, movies, you're right. Movies, videos, TV, everybody's watching this or that. It's enough to read something about it and say, okay, that sounds pretty trashy, I'm not going to watch that. It's a lot of this stuff, like you're saying, it just amounts to propaganda. It's just like really well done propaganda that has this subtle or not so subtle message that's telling you, and it's telling kids, unfortunately, because it's a lot of kids' entertainment now, that there's nothing wrong with this and there's nothing wrong with that, and not to criticize anybody for anything, and it's just giving us completely the wrong message. So of course that's not true, you know. No, criticize people for taking a stand for the truth. Absolutely criticize them for that. But don't criticize anybody for any kind of sexual thing or any kind of immoral behavior or anything like that. By no means criticize them for that. Just criticize them for being traditional about their faith, or then you can make fun of them all you want.
Well, I don't want to carry off the topic here, but he has that whole chapter where he deals with the fact that we can forgive, we can take for personality and in personal areas, we can take a lot of stuff and not complain. But he says, when it's out there, then we have to fight for it.
Yeah.
We have to speak up, we have to fight. And even if it involves war, you know, I guess he was in Russia at one time, so there, you know, involves war, and you have to fight for it when it's out there, when it's not, it's not a personal thing, but it exists out there. You have to speak out, you have to fight for good out there, not just be quiet and say nothing and just let everything pass.
Yeah. I can't remember if I brought this up in this study or not. I know I mentioned it to some people. But my spiritual father was reading a book on the Holocaust, and he's actually Jewish. His background is Jewish. So that's kind of close to home for him. But it's on something like, the book is called The Rise of the Third Reich or something like that.
And, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich?
Yeah, something like that. And he said it's a fantastic book, just in the sense that it gives all of these details of how it happened and how people just went along with it. And he said the remarkable thing is that as Hitler was rising in power and he just kept taking one step after another, he said nobody would speak up. He was taking away everybody's freedom, you know. He kept instituting a new law, a new practice. Now we're going to do this. Now we're going to do that. But he kept telling everybody, if you go along with what I'm telling you, if you do what I'm telling you to do, then you'll be economically provided for. You know, his people are afraid after World War I of going through and the depression and everything, of going through suffering, of not having enough to eat. He said, we'll make sure you have enough to eat. We'll make sure, you know, we'll provide for your needs. So it was like always this promise, we'll take care of you, but meanwhile, we're taking away this freedom, we're taking away this freedom, we're taking away this freedom. So it was just this this kind of progression towards this fascist totalitarian state, you know, this kind of horrible society, and nobody spoke up. And so this is the point my spiritual father always makes, like at some point we have to speak up, we have to say no, that's evil, what you're doing is evil, that's hurting people, that's dehumanizing people, it's terrible, you know. And we can't just simply accept everything. And so Archbishop Averke, that's a really important point. He says it's one thing to forgive personal offenses, and that we're absolutely called to do. It's another thing to just let it slide when it's something that's harming other people. It's harming our children. Yeah. It's harming society. then we have to speak up, and we can't just say, oh, you know, we forgive. No. It doesn't mean hate them, but you have to speak up. And a great example is St. Nicholas, the wonder worker, when he punched Arius or slapped him or whatever he did. You know, it wasn't that he had a personal grudge against Arius, not at all. If it were just on that level, he could forgive him. But it was that Arius kept propagating heresy, which was leading people astray, and St. Nicholas loves children, right? He loves the children of the church, and he said, I'm not going to let the children be harmed by this garbage. And so when Arius wouldn't shut up, he slapped him. And so sometimes you have to slap Arius.
Father Daniel?
Yes, ma'am.
That reminds me of the in our little red prayer book, the 9 ways of participating in another's sin.
Yes.
Number 8 is by silence, what it says. And that's what you're talking about.
That's right.
You know, by not speaking up, you're participating in what they're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. If something's evil, then we have to say that it's evil. We have to be clear about that. And that's not going against what the Lord says when the Lord says not to judge and not to condemn. It's not what the Lord's talking about. So I don't know if anybody watches Father Josiah Trinham's YouTube videos, but he just did one this past week that was on do not judge, what that means, what it means and what it doesn't mean, do not judge. It was very good. So he makes this point that there's an important distinction between sort of condemning people and you know, saying they're going to go to hell, judging their spiritual state, judging their hearts, and being clear about what's evil. We have to be clear about what evil. So if there's an action that's evil, then we're absolutely to judge the action and to say, that's an evil action. That act is terrible. It's sinful. It's harming people. People are harming themselves. And we're not going to pretend that that's not true. But we're not saying that person's going to hell. We're not saying we hate them. Absolutely not. And again, this goes back to what Kathy was saying about love. God in his love for us gives us laws. He gives us rules. He tells us, do this, don't do that. That's not condemning us. That's not hating us. It's love, to be clear about what's true and what's false. We might read a few little passages, and this will be kind of going over some of what we've already said, but to go a little bit deeper or to make it a little more well-rounded, why don't we look, first of all, at page 96, and this is on idleness. Idleness, and we've mentioned distraction, so it's related to the issue of distraction. So we'll look at that, and then we'll move on to the next chapter and read something from chapter 8, which deals with this thing about personal offenses versus harming situation where others are being harmed. So page 96, about the middle, there's that paragraph that begins with Saint Ignatius. It says, Saint Ignatius says, and by the way, this is Saint Ignatius Brianchaninov, the Russian saint from the 19th century, who wrote the book The Arena and other spiritual classics. It says, Saint Ignatius says, one needs to forbid himself every idle activity. We need to allocate our time in such a way as to be constantly occupied with sensible, useful, and practical activities, fulfilling one's duties, private and public, without excessive fuss or agitation, will never lead to a distracted life. And so this is an important point. It's saying you don't have to be a monk in the desert to live a life free of harmful distraction. You can go around, you can go about your life doing your duties without falling into sinful distraction if your heart's in the right place. So he says, fulfilling one's duties, private and public, without excessive fuss or agitation, will never lead to a distracted life, but on the contrary, is conducive to attention to oneself and vigilance. Distractedness is fostered by idleness or frivolous activities, which are akin to idleness. Therefore, above all, it is necessary to fear and avoid idleness. Foolish jokes and idle talk are inappropriate and harmful, yet they have become popular and are valued by people who are incapable of determining the seriousness and importance of what is being said. Also harmful is daydreaming, which drives a person out of real life into a fantastic, unreal world and causes him to be distracted by thoughts and feelings that concern non-existent things. So, daydreaming, we might not think of as something sinful, but the point is, if we're engaged in an unreality, it's like avoiding reality, then it's a kind of distraction which can very easily lend itself to various kinds of passions. And what we're doing when we're fantasizing, even if it doesn't seem like a sinful kind of fantasy in and of itself, obviously some fantasies are sinful in and of themselves, but I mean the sort of like the subject matter of the fantasy, but whatever kind of daydreaming, sort of fantasizing it is, it's looking away in some sense from Christ, because Christ is reality, right? Christ is the truth, the reality of the world. And when we're engaging in this kind of fantasizing, daydreaming world, it's looking away somehow. And when we look away, then we become very susceptible to the evil one. So it's putting ourselves in a bad position when we do that. And especially if it's habitual, it's something that it's sort of our go-to thing, you know? Like, life is stressful, life is hard, you start to go into your world of imagination. I think this is more of a temptation for some people than others. Some people, you know, sort of do a lot of fantasizing in their minds, and other people maybe not so much. So another thing, he doesn't, obviously decades ago that he's writing this, but as I was reading what he says about distractedness, I was thinking, yeah, the internet, you know, social media, all of this stuff completely falls into that category of idleness, you know. I mean, you have an important email to write somebody, you're checking on somebody's health, fine, that's good. That's a good use of the internet or social media or whatever. But just like spending hours scrolling through things, you know, I mean, that's idleness. I'm sorry, it is. I do it, but it's not helping us. It's just not, you know? And I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. You can spend hours doing that. You know, you're like, you think you're just going to check something for a few minutes. Let me see if, you know, there are any important whatever posts here on Facebook or, you know, something, or if there's any news I should be aware of or whatever. And one thing leads to another, and then hours have gone by and you're like, what did I just spend all my time doing? You know, I mean, 99% of it was just gossip, and I don't feel at all edified. You know, I'm not in a better place. In fact, I'm in a worse place. So this is what he's talking about. It's just a different form of it. Discuss amongst yourselves. I'm going to see.
Well, think about, for those of us right here, probably Facebook is one of our primary social media things. But like, the folks that are Jay and Charlotte's kids' age and younger, I mean, it's not just Facebook. It's Instagram. It's Twitter. It's Snapchat. It's, well, all those are old fogey stuff now, too. I mean, there's other new stuff. It's TikTok. I mean, yeah. I think how distracted I get just with that one platform of Facebook. But all these other younger people with multiple social media platforms that are constantly bombarding them. And I don't know that I could, you know, fend off those things if I were their age. I have enough trouble not doing what you just said. Like, you know, all of a sudden it's been 2 hours. I've been on Facebook and I'm thinking, you know, and mom will say, did you practice the piano or the banjo today? I'm like, oh, I didn't have time. Well, I had 2 hours. I mean, obviously, because I was reading memes and getting mad at them on Facebook.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I hear from teens all the time about what they're doing, and I mean, especially now since there's been this, you know, with COVID and everything, and everybody's sort of more isolated, they're spending all their time on social media. Like that's their life, and so I don't know what the solution is other than just to keep trying to encourage young people. But obviously, we have to work on ourselves too. But you're right. It's for teens, especially people younger than us. They're moving on so quickly. They don't use Facebook at all anymore. I mean, that's like not a thing for teens at all. And you're right. It's just whatever the latest thing is, Snapchat and then TikTok and whatever they're into. And there's just so much garbage that they're exposed to that way. Not to mention, there's just social media, but then of course there's like all the really kind of toxic stuff that can lead to, including pornography, etc. So and they're just getting hooked into that stuff. And this, I mean, to me it's just so clearly diabolical, all of that. You know, and it almost makes me think like the devil just invented the internet and you know, we're just all kind of hooked into it now, but because it has some potential for good and it has just incredible potential for harm. It's just unbelievable. People are just, I mean, talk about attachments. Like I was talking about idols today. I mean, people are, it's a complete idol for people. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, it's like, and what do you, if that's your whole life and how you're connected to people, then how do you get away from that? It's really hard. But I think at least to be aware of the problem and to do whatever we can to fight it ourselves in our own life and to carve out sort of a place within our life for just, you know, not engaging in all of that idleness, but being present with God, being focused on things that are good, taking in good things that will nourish our souls and not harm them, and then in whatever way we can to encourage others to do the same, even in ways that may seem insignificant to us. That's what we can do. I mean, that's the way that we can fight. So, and Saint Seraphim says, acquire the peace of the Holy Spirit and thousands around you will be saved. So even if it seems like a losing battle and we can't help others, fight for that peace of the Holy Spirit in your own life, and the more we acquire that, the more we will be able to help others, even in miraculous ways, by the grace of God. You know, because prayer can make a difference. And besides, it's never hopeless. Even as bad as it may look, we know who wins in the end. So we just have to keep being faithful. Just trying to figure out what's going on behind me.
In terms of, we tend to focus a lot of times on politics, you know, this plan will work better and this plan, but it seems to me reading this that even some of the best discussions tend to be, you know, fantasizing, well, if we do this, maybe we could solve this problem. If we do that, maybe we'll solve this problem. When in reality, you know, it does matter what you do, but it doesn't, you know, you fix one problem, another comes along, you know. Political life is just reality. It's going to have its faults and its problems, and no system in the end is going to cure it. And so to try to spend all this time coming up with the perfect system and dealing with all that is almost, it's almost to the point of fantasy. At least, you know, the Marxists have certainly perfected that.
Yep.
but you know, could be the other side too. You know.
Yeah.
And it's distracting. It becomes a huge distraction. You know, when in reality it's very ineffective. At least you would say so.
Yeah,
seems so.
Yeah, that's another. I watched these two videos by Father Josiah yesterday. One was on what it means not to judge, and the other one was on, he called it What America Needs. And he said he watched the Democratic Convention, he watched the Republican Convention. The Democrats have their ideas about what America needs, the Republicans have their ideas about what America needs. He said at least the Republicans officially are pro-life, you know. But he just said, like, it's one political solution against another political solution. And ultimately, as he said, what America needs is to repent. And short of repentance, these sort of political solutions imposed from without are not, they're not ultimately going to fix things for us. So unless people's hearts change, unless we repent, we're going to still be in a mess. So, yeah. And that's, it is, it's a kind of fantasy or a kind of sort of projecting things outside, which means then I don't have to deal with myself because it's those people's fault, you know, it's, and that, you know, like we may say like, we agree with this party or we agree with this politician and, you know, it's not that we're relativizing things. Certainly, we believe that abortion is wrong. We would want to have laws that at least limit abortion, if not make it illegal, you know, etc. But if you think just because we change the laws, then we're going to live in some kind of paradise, and you know everybody's going to be good and treat each other well, that's not true, because you know people's hearts are still corrupt. So that's not, it's not going to create, there's no utopia in this world. And so that kind of thinking that if only we do this, then we'll have a utopia, it's magical thinking and it's never going to work in this world. It's just not. So that's why our main focus has to be changing our hearts. And through changing our own hearts, possibly influencing other people to change their hearts too. So, but let's go ahead and turn to that chapter 8, and we've discussed it pretty well already, but I just wanted to read one little section, and this is on page 103. And so the idea is, having said what we just said about changing our hearts, there's this point about, again, holding other people accountable for their evil actions versus forgiving personal offenses. And with St. Nicholas slapping Arius as a great example, but let's just hear again Archbishop Averroes' words about this. So I'm looking at page 103, the beginning of that paragraph that's near the middle of the page. He writes, "A Christian cannot be at peace and have friendship with thieves, murderers, rapists, nor perverts. In principle, a Christian cannot live in peace and friendship with all of those people who clearly and boldly break the law of God, harm the peace and welfare of human society, who prevent people from drawing close to God, and introduce discord and disorder into the soul. It is necessary to steadfastly remember that when the gospel speaks of the forgiveness of sins and offenses, it has in mind personal sins and personal offenses. However, we usually understand and do everything the other way around. Self-assertive human pride forgives everything except for personal offenses. You can be both an atheist and a blasphemer, and that is fine, only don't touch me. You can be a thief and a murderer, just leave me alone. You can be any type of scoundrel, but if you don't do anything bad to me personally, especially if you do something pleasing to me, then you are already a good person. The opposite is also true. If the best possible person in some way, even unintentionally, wounds our pride, then there's trouble. Enmity between us is unavoidable, and he immediately becomes our mortal enemy. This is how everything is distorted. Our law is such. The one who indulges our self-assertive human pride, the one who pleases our passions, is good and our best friend, but the one who speaks to us even one word of reproach, even if it contains salvific truth, immediately becomes our enemy. So, great point, right? He's distinguishing between what we ought to do and what we oftentimes usually do, which is we ought to hold people accountable for their sinfulness, but if people offend us personally, to forgive them. And if we're humble, that's what we'll do. But he says we sort of do the opposite. We excuse anything as long as sort of we're benefiting from those people. But as soon as somebody speaks ill of us, then they're our enemy. We write them off, right? So that's what we want to watch out for. It's kind of turning it on its head, turning it upside down, when we should be doing the opposite.
Book of Proverbs, it says, "Do not rebuke a fool." Do not rebuke a fool.
Yeah.
Or he will. I don't know the phrase, but he won't like you. That's a very paraphrased rendering. It says, "But rebuke a wise man, he will love you."
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. If we're wise, then we appreciate constructive criticism, you know? Somebody comes and says, "Hey, you know, you could be doing this better." "Oh, you're right. I could be. Thank you." But in our pride, instead, we get mad at that person. We fume at them and resent them and think bad thoughts about them. And yeah. And this is the whole problem, you know, it's that the world is all caught up in pride, and so people aren't able to receive correction. So even if we manage as Christians to really lovingly speak the truth and say, well, you know, you're not supposed to, a man is not supposed to marry a man, you know, and we're just telling you the truth, but it's like, well, now we've personally offended them, and you know, because part of it is that in our culture what's happened is that people have confused their sins with their identity. So we identify with the sin, and as Christians we don't, we distinguish between sins or passions and identity. We say your true identity is as a son or daughter of God. You're made in the image of God. The sins are accretions. They're things that you've gotten like besmattered with mud or something, you know, you're covered with mud, but that's not you. That's not your identity. That's not who you are. It can be washed away. But in our culture, there's this complete marriage of identity and sin, and people can't distinguish between the two. And so if you speak the truth about sin, then they feel personally attacked. They think you're attacking the core of who they are. Well, we could move on and talk a little bit about chapter 9. This is a meaty chapter. It's definitely along the lines of the main theme of this book, which is struggling for virtue, of course. And specifically, this chapter is on waging unseen warfare. And unseen warfare is it's a principle. It's this idea of, you know, fighting the good fight, spiritual warfare. But there's actually a book that I think he has in mind in this chapter. In fact, he quotes from it, so I know he has it in mind. It's called Unseen Warfare. It's a spiritual classic. It's very interesting because it was, the original version of this book was written by a 16th century Venetian priest named Lorenzo Scupoli. So he's a Roman Catholic priest in the 16th century. He wrote this book on spiritual warfare. And it was found by Saint Nicodemus of Mount Athos, who basically, he liked it. And wherever there were things that he thought were a little bit off, he corrected them. So he created a sort of orthodoxized version of this book. And then Saint Theophan the Recluse in the next century. Saint Nicodemus lived in the 18th century, the 1700s. Then the next century, in the 19th century, Saint Theophan the Recluse found this book in its revised form by Saint Nicodemus, and then he further revised it. And that's the way in which it's come down to us in our English translation. So revised by Saint Theophan and Saint Nicodemus, and really good book. We might at some point in our study actually read the book, Unseen Warfare. But I just wanted to mention that because he quotes from it in this chapter, although I don't think he specifically mentions the book. But we'll talk about what he quotes. But anyway, so this idea of spiritual warfare, and if we look at the bottom of page 111, that last paragraph on page 111, he says, "A battle with evil in my own soul is a true Christian's fundamental motto, and it is the one true principle, the one sound and reliable foundation on which one can build the well-being of humanity." So, again, you know, this addresses this idea of evil in society, how we can help. Well, where we have to begin is battling with evil in our own soul. You want to help the world, that's the starting point. If you're not doing that, and you're just externalizing everything and, you know, trying to fix everything out here, fix other people, and you're not dealing with evil in your own soul, then you're not really going to help. It's going to be like John Crichton was talking about, a political solution, but it's really empty in the end. It doesn't really solve anything. So that point, and then on the bottom of page 113, I want to start quoting towards the bottom, so not at the beginning of this paragraph, but about five lines up. There's the sentence that begins, "And the battle with evil." It's five lines up from the bottom on page 113. He says, "And the battle with evil being conducted by modern people is not successful for the most part, because people battle not so much with evil as with other people, at the same time harboring that very same evil in their souls. Indeed, the very distinction between good and evil in contemporary humanity, fallen away from God, has become blurred. Evil is often considered good and vice versa. With such a confused understanding of good and evil, the correct and effectual battle with true evil is made more difficult. But most importantly, we repeat, is that this basic truth is forgotten. The only one who has battled with evil in his own... That only one who has battled with evil in his own soul can successfully wage battle with evil in general, and therefore the battle with evil must begin in one's own soul with unseen warfare." Now let's turn to the next page, 115, and read that middle paragraph. John, do you mind reading?
Okay. "This unseen warfare is not easy. It is much more difficult than any ordinary earthly warfare, for it is much easier to battle with other people than with oneself. In the words of the Holy Father, one who engages in this warfare is fighting against himself, or more correctly, his own self-love, self-centeredness, or in secular terminology, his egoism, which is rooted in self-assertive human pride. In other words, the essence of unseen warfare is a persistent battle with the spirit of self-assertive human pride and all its offspring, various passions and vices."
Why don't you read the next paragraph also?
Okay. "As this battle is extremely difficult, it is impossible to rely only upon one's human powers Essential also is supernatural divine help, the power of God's grace that, as we know, is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, the Holy Fathers say that he who desires to be victorious in unseen warfare must establish the following four dispositions or inclinations in his heart. 1. Never in any way rely on yourself. 2. Always have in your heart complete, resolute hope in the one God. 3. Work unceasingly. And 4. Always be in prayer.
Okay, so this is what he's quoting from the book Unseen Warfare. These four principles are given in that book and emphasized. So always to rely on, never in any way to rely on yourself, but always to have in your heart complete, resolute hope in the one God. So you don't rely on yourself, you rely on God. You work unceasingly. In other words, you remain vigilant, keeping vigil, keeping watch, and always being in prayer. So learning to pray without ceasing. So these are the principles of spiritual warfare. Now, he says more about these a couple pages later, and that would be worth reading also, specifically what he says. On the bottom of page 117 to the top of page 118. So here he writes, the Holy Fathers indicate the following four dispositions for this purpose. First, try to perceive your weakness, basing your observations on all your life experiences, and constantly maintain an awareness of the fact that you yourself cannot do any good without God's help. St. Peter Damascene says the following about this. There is nothing greater than to realize your weakness and ignorance, and nothing worse than not to be aware of them. St. Maximus the Confessor teaches that the foundation of every virtue is the realization of human weakness. St. John Chrysostom confirms, only one who thinks that he is nothing will know himself the best. So that's the first principle, never to rely on yourself. The second principle, always to rely on God. He writes, ask God in prayer that he give you the realization of your weakness and insignificance, but first establish in yourself the conviction that you do not have this awareness and that it can be acquired only as God's gift. Third, always fear for yourself and be wary of the crafty designs of Satan, with whom it is impossible to grapple without God's help. So this is why we must always be vigilant. And fourth, if you happen to fall into some kind of sin, immediately recognize your weakness and complete helplessness. Impress upon yourself that God allowed this fall so that you would know better your feebleness and insignificance before God and would learn to disdain yourself. And so, of course, we turn to God in prayer, seeking forgiveness and restoration. So, and it, of course, there's, you know, it can sound somehow negative or discouraging when he repeats, and you find the same thing in the book Unseen Warfare. There's this repetition of this theme, not to rely on yourself, that there's no good thing in yourself, that you can't do anything by your own strength. So that sounds like it's putting things in a very negative way. But There's a negative side to it, but there's also a very positive side to it, which is that we can rely on God. And with God, all things are possible. And with Him, we have the strength to do it, right? So there's a negative side, yes, but there's also a very positive side. So in other words, not to hope in ourselves, but to hope in God. That's really the point of all of this. So, by the grace of God, we are what we are. And you know, we can't do anything apart from His grace. So any thoughts from this chapter or any other thoughts in general from what we've looked at so far?
bottom of page 119, just to go back to a little song we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
He writes, he says, that he is all-knowing and wise, knows what is good and necessary for us, and that he is, as ever good, is ready at any moment to help us with unspeakable love in any way that we need.
Yes.
So it ties in with what was said earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, he loves us. Unspeakable love. That's such a wonderful description. So we can trust him. And we don't have to be afraid. We just have to be wise. We just have to be aware and vigilant. And because the danger, it's as long as we're trusting in God and hoping in him, we're protected. The danger comes as soon as we forget to do that and we rely on ourselves. That's always the danger. And the devil's going to do everything he can to entice us away from hoping in God and putting our hope in something else, relying on ourselves, you know, giving into pride, giving into vanity and conceit. So that's why we have to be always on our guard. And as soon as that kind of proud thought comes to say, I'm not going to listen to that. I don't believe that. I don't believe that idea. That's from Satan. That's from the enemy. And I'm not going to pay attention to it. I'm going to turn to Christ. So. Will y'all, anything else? Maybe that's a good, that's enough for today. And we can just plan in the next session to talk about those last three chapters, 10, 11, and 12. They're all, these last ones are pretty short. And of course, number 12 is nice. It's like all spoken to the priest. it's very convicting for me. But it's good.
We'll try not to judge you after we read that.
Thank you. Well, if you, as long as you judge me for my benefit, then that's okay. You can do that. Just yes. not in a way that does spiritual harm to you. If you tell me, Father, we read this chapter and you're clearly not measuring up, please see if you can repent a little bit, and then that'll be good for me.
I could never imagine something like that happening.
Well. But it would be good for me. So maybe you could do that just for the benefit of my soul. That would be it would be a charitable act. So, all right. Thank you all for a good discussion, and God willing, we'll continue next week. And after this book. We're going to be looking at the epistles of St. John. That's going to be our next thing. So we read St. John's Gospel. Now we're going to look at his epistles. And then later on, we'll also look at the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse. So a lot of St. John. Yeah, we're gonna go through all of St. John's writings eventually. But interspersed with other things. So that's the plan. I think a few weeks back, or before we began our study, I sent out kind of a list of the readings that I was planning on us looking at and reading together. And that may change a little bit, but that's kind of the basic game plan. So, okay, why don't we end with the...
I'm really interested in that Revelation one, because my stepfather, I think I mentioned to you before, he'll ask questions trying to figure out what might be unorthodox about the Orthodox Church. And so he asked Rick Friday, he said, so do y'all, does that church believe in the second coming of Christ? And Rick, typically Rick does not respond like this, but, or I guess I shouldn't even be telling on him.
Anyway, he said, well, it's in the Bible, isn't it? And I'm like, that's, anyway.
Yeah.
But he, you know,
yeah.
I'll be very interested to, went back and looked at my catechism notebook and looked at what we had discussed in catechism class, but I'll definitely be interested in looking at that book for the first time as an Orthodox Christian.
Yeah.
And hearing your thoughts and everyone else's thoughts on it from a completely different perspective than what I've grown up with as a Protestant. So I'm so glad we're going to look at that.
Yeah, and more importantly, not my thoughts or our thoughts, but Archbishop Iwerki has a commentary on the Book of Revelation. So that's, yeah, so that'll be what we'll use as our secondary text. We can read the Book of Revelation, we can look at what Archbishop Iwerki says. And of course, he's also relying on the fathers of the church and their commentaries. So that'll be very helpful. We absolutely believe whatever's in the Bible. And it's interesting what things are not in the Bible that other people believe that we don't believe, like the rapture. So we'll talk about that. So God bless you all. Let's end with a prayer.